Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Psych Files, the show for anyone interested in human behavior. Michael Britt here, and we are up to episode 98, an overview of evolutionary psychology. I'm very excited about this episode. Got an interview in just a few minutes with Dr. David Buss, one of the primary researchers in the field of evolutionary psychology. And I have, over the past, six, 8 months, have received a number of emails and also messages through Facebook saying, hey, I really would like to learn more about evolutionary psychology. So I'm happy to bring you this interview. I want to thank the two Facebook friends who wanted to hear about evolutionary psychology, and they are Maddie G. and Sarah F. So thanks, Maddie and Sarah. Stick around for the end of this episode. I just wanted to say a few things as I'm approaching episode 100. Just a few thoughts about that episode. And so I want to tell you about that. So if you would stick around at the end of the interview with Dr. Buss. Quick introduction on Dr. Buss. He received his PhD from the University of California, Berkeley. His career began at Harvard, and he later moved to the University of Michigan. And he is currently a professor of psychology at the University of Texas. Primary interests include human sexuality, mating strategies, conflict between the sexes, homicide, stalking, and sexual victimization. Dr. Buss is the author of over 200 scientific articles and 6 books, including a recent one which we're going to talk about briefly called The Evolution of Desire. So this is the man to talk to if you want to learn about evolutionary psychology. I think you're going to find this episode really interesting. Without further ado, let's go to the interview with Dr. Buss. We are here with Dr. David Buss. Dr. Buss, you are one of the premier researchers in the field of evolutionary psychology, so I'm very happy to have you on the Psych Files, and I appreciate your taking the time to be with me.
Oh, thank you. Delighted to do it.
Great. So I was drawn to giving you a call after I saw your article in the February-March 2009 American Psychologist called The Great Struggles of Life. The issue was devoted to Darwin, I guess, what, it's the 150th anniversary of publication?
Yes, 150th anniversary of the publication of On the Origin of Species.
So the whole edition, I think, is dedicated to articles on Darwin. But yours in particular, and you teach and have published a book now in its third edition on evolutionary psychology. This is clearly your major focus of your research. Anything in particular draw you into this?
Yes. Basically, I started out my career in psychology and went to graduate school in personality psychology. And what I was always interested in was human nature. What is the foundation of human nature? What makes us tick? What makes us get out of bed in the morning? What drives us to do the things that we do? And in graduate school, I TA'd for classes in personality psychology, so I became familiar with all the existing grand theories of personality which purported to explain human nature. And I found parts of each of them interesting and compelling, but each one seemed ungrounded in some way. You know, there was no logical foundation for choosing one versus another of the theories. And so it really was my search for some theoretical foundation for studying human nature that drew me to evolutionary theory. At the time, there wasn't a field called evolutionary psychology, and there weren't people who called themselves evolutionary psychologists. But when I started doing research related to it, that put me into contact with a scattering of other professors from around the country and around the world who were doing it. Eventually, it led to a movement and the creation of a discipline of evolutionary psychology. But really wasn't until the 80s that you had empirical work that was testing evolutionary hypotheses, and it's really then that the field started to gain some traction, because prior to that, you had a lot of speculation, you had a lot of theorizing, but little or no empirical work to correspond to it. Psychology is very much of an empirical discipline, so if you don't have empirical tests, psychologists generally don't pay too much attention.
Now, let's make sure that we're grounded in evolution theory. I mean, that topic alone has filled many volumes. I'm not going to ask you to go, well, it all started back with the HMS Beagle. If you can, give us the highlights of the theory. I also want to make sure that we're clear on some of the misunderstandings. I know that when I taught this in my History of Psych course, I used to start off with this Far Side cartoon, which had a picture of a giraffe, and he had a short neck and long legs, and then there was about six pictures, and then by the end he had a long neck and short legs, and then the caption was the evolution of the giraffe. So the giraffe is a good example, I guess, of evolution theory. So go ahead.
Okay, well, basically, we might start with just defining evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And evolution simply means change over time. So there can be the evolution of stars. There can be cultural evolution, change over time, and cultural institutions and ideas and values. And then there's organic evolution, or genic evolution, as we now call it, change over time in genes and gene frequencies. That evolution occurred, that is, that change occurred over time in organic structures, was known long before Darwin, or at least was believed to occur by many scientists before Darwin. What was lacking was a theory that could explain why change took place over time. And that was basically the theory that Darwin supplied. Now, there were theories before Darwin, such as Lamarck, but Lamarck had a kind of a mistaken view of inheritance. He had a notion of the inheritance of acquired characteristics. So, for example, a giraffe striving to get those high leaves up in the tree stretched out the neck a bit, and then with that stretched out neck left longer necks to descendants, the notion of an inheritance of these acquired characteristics. And we now know that that does not occur.
Well, let me ask you this question.
Would
Lamarck's idea be similar to, like, for example, I'm sort of a, I don't know, skinny, you know, I'm not really that big person, about 5'7". If I spend, a lot of time building up my muscles so that I became a, you know, pretty muscular guy, maybe a weightlifter, I would not pass that on to my children.
Is right,
that similar
exactly.
To the same thing,
yes.
About the necks and all that?
Yes, and that's an excellent example. So the inheritance of what acquired characteristics is now known to be wrong. What Darwin supplied was the mechanism by which change takes place. He called it the theory of natural selection, and it involves basically three components or three ingredients. First, there have to be individual differences or variation or variance. These can be in anything, variation in height, variation in reaction time, variation in visual acuity. And then the second component is that some of these variants have to lead to greater survival and reproduction than other variants. So in the case of giraffes, to get back to that example, giraffes that happened to be slightly taller than other giraffes ate better, and they were able to get those tall leaves, so they survived long enough to pass on their genes for the longer necks to their offspring. And so you have variation, and then you have differential reproduction as a consequence of that variation. And, of course, the variation has to have a heritable basis.
So the giraffe who, through chance, has a longer neck is able to eat better and, as a result, probably survives longer, in fact, survives long enough to reproduce and passes on this characteristic to its progeny who passed that along.
Exactly. Yeah. Each species faces and has faced different selection pressures from their environment. Creatures, great and beautiful, have been and continue to be evolving.
That's the key part that we think of when we think about Darwin is natural selection. But he did try to touch on, I get from your sense, the idea of sexual selection.
Yes, and this is a fascinating story. Darwin had a wonderful habit, which was that he forced himself to confront facts that seemed inconsistent with his theory. And so there were things that he started to notice that didn't fit in with this so-called survival selection, which was another phrase that was used to describe natural selection. And when people think about evolution by natural selection, they tend to think in phrases like that, survival of the fittest, organisms struggling for mere survival. But what Darwin noted was that there were some things that just seemed perplexing on these survival accounts. One was brilliant plumage of peacocks. How could this weird, metabolically expensive structure possibly have evolved? You know, it's like a neon sign to predators, you know, advertising fast food.
We've talked before on the podcast about confirmation bias and how we generally tend to look only for the information that confirms our beliefs. But you're saying Darwin was not so troubled by that issue. He actually did keep his eye out for the possibility that he was wrong.
Interestingly enough, he was aware of that confirmation bias in himself. That is, he noticed that he had a tendency to forget facts that were inconsistent with his theory, and so he forced himself to write them down in order to confront them. And so he noticed things as I mentioned, the peacock. He even said, the sight of a peacock gives me nightmares. He mentioned this in a personal correspondence. And he also noted sex differences, that is, differences between males and females of the same species in size or shape or morphology. And that perplexed him as well, because both sexes face the same survival problems. Both sexes have to eat. Both sexes have to fend off predators. Why would the sexes differ? And in response to these anomalies that couldn't be explained by natural selection, Darwin came up with, finally, a second theory that he called the theory of sexual selection. Now, this theory of sexual selection dealt with the evolution of characteristics due to mating advantage, not survival advantage. And basically, sexual selection involves two component processes by which mating advantage is achieved. In one, it's called intrasexual competition, or intra means within sexual, the sexes, so within sex competition. And the stereotypic image of intrasexual competition is two stags locking horns in combat, with the victor gaining sexual access to the female and the loser basically remaining mateless and biting the evolutionary dust. And so whatever qualities lead to success in these same-sex battles, those qualities get passed on in greater numbers because of the sexual access that the victors gain, the mating success. So that's intrasexual competition. The logic also can apply to things like competition for position and status hierarchies.
So would another example be like when gorillas sort of beat their chests and make big display, scream and yell? I mean, actually a lot of species, I guess, do that, where they make loud noises. And if not physically fighting with each other, there are displays with other males. So it's male, in this case here, you call that intrasexual. So this would be males fighting with other males to, as I often hear, quote unquote, gain access to females. Right,
right. Exactly. And there are other forms of competition, so that those can be physical displays to deter rivals, so basically scare them off. The second component is really interesting. It's called inter, or between the sexes, selection. Darwin called this one female choice. And the logic is very simple, but it's very powerful. The logic is that if members of one sex, so let's say if females have a preference for certain qualities in the opposite sex, then those of the opposite sex who possess those desired qualities have a mating advantage. They get chosen more often as mates. Those who lack the desired qualities get banished or shunned or excluded from mating. And so, again, you see evolution, which is change over time, due to an increase in the frequency of desired characteristics. So if females prefer males who, for example, provide them with food, then males who are good at collecting and gathering food and providing to females have a mating advantage. And you in fact see that in many different species. Now, one of the interesting things is that even though Darwin called this process female choice, he called it that because he observed that females in many species tended to be more choosy about who they mated with than males of those same species. When it comes to humans, it turns out these component processes of sexual selection operate in both sexes. So that is, in our species, men as well as women exercise mate choice, and both men and women compete with each other for access to members of the opposite sex. So we have what's called a mutual mate choice, and competition among women can get very vicious. It takes forms that are typically not physical contest forms, but verbal forms, gossip, these are all forms of competition. So
degrading other females, isn't that one?
Yes. Mate poaching is another form of competition that both sexes engage in.
Mate poaching?
Yeah, mate poaching, stealing someone else's mate, either for a short-term sexual encounter or for a longer-term relationship. To get back to Darwin, though, this theory of sexual selection was absolutely brilliant because it solved these anomalies that could not be explained by the theory of natural selection. So the brilliant plumage of peacocks exists because female peahens prefer to mate with males with the brilliant luminescent feathers. And we even know something about why, that those luminescent feathers provide a health cue. Those peacocks that have a high parasite load, parasites tend to degrade the luminescence of the plumage. And so peacocks with the more brilliant plumage are in fact healthier peacocks. And so females are selecting basically on health cue that can then be passed down to their offspring. The theory of sexual selection also explained why there are sex differences. Sex differences arise through these processes of intersexual competition and preferential mate choice. So, for example, in the case of males and contest competition, in species that have this contest competition, those males who are larger and stronger generally have an advantage in these battles, and so you have selection pressure for the evolution of greater size and strength in males and not an analogous selection pressure on females. And so you get sexual dimorphism or differences between the sexes arising through this process of sexual selection.
I've talked before about what we call a matching hypothesis, but actually what that is where similarly attractive males and females tend to couple. This was sort of a surprise to me when I looked at your article. You say he called that cross-character assortment?
Yeah, he noticed that the most dominant males would tend to be paired up with the most physically attractive females. It's a phenomenon that has been documented in humans and is one of the most well-documented examples of what you just called cross-character assortment. That is the best predictor of the occupational status of a man that a woman marries is her physical attractiveness. Physically attractive females tend to marry up in socioeconomic status. They're matched, but matched on different characteristics, and this arises from a fundamental sex difference that I documented in my cross-cultural work of 37 cultures, which is that men tend to place greater importance on physical appearance and physical attractiveness in selecting a long-term mate, whereas women place greater emphasis on a man's status and resource acquisition abilities in selecting a mate. It's a universal sex difference, and it plays out in who ends up getting coupled. Everyone may want someone who's extremely attractive and has a lot of resources and who's intelligent, has a great personality, but it's only those who are high in mate value who can succeed in attracting those. And so the eights end up getting paired off with the eights and the tens with the tens and the sixes with the sixes.
Mate value is a good term for that. It's funny how we all seem to have a sense of our own mate value as we get older. We get a sense of, okay, that's attractive, maybe because of media, etc. We see, you know, Angelina Jolie. We go, okay, well, now that's attractive. So now where am I in that scale right there? And we all get a sense of that, don't we? It's weird.
Yes. I think we have evolved psychology that is attuned to our own mate value, because if we didn't consider the costs of making mistakes, now there's a lot of trial and error, of course, but let's just use this crude numbering system for the moment. If you are a six and you're focusing your mating efforts on nines and tens, you're going to be striking out a lot and wasting a lot of mating effort. Similarly, if you're focusing your efforts on twos and threes, and you're a six, then you're not going to be mating with someone who is as valuable as you could obtain. And so it paid reproductive dividends. It was very adaptive to have an accurate self-assessment of your mate value and even update that self-assessment as you move through life, and it, because it does change over time. So people, for example, if they become extremely successful in their careers, then their mate value increases. Or if they get fired from their job, they might lose some mate value. It's not a fixed value, but it changes over time.
Or I can imagine once you get into your 70s, let's say, or 80s, there are fewer men. So even if you're an unattractive male, if you make it to the 70s and you know, maybe your wife dies, so now you're a widow, you come to understand that you have a high value because there's so few of you.
Right. Yeah, that's basically what's known as the effect of sex ratio. In other words, the ratio of males to females in the mating pool. When there's a surplus of women, then men are in a much more powerful position and their mate value increases. And similarly, when there's a surplus of men, women are in a greater position of power and their mate value increases.
Or if you go to a college where there's a lot of women and not many men,
right, exactly. Local mating populations have strong effects on this. And this is, we've seen this throughout human history. For example, with the early pioneers and explorers, there was a huge sex ratio there where there was a surplus of men. You know, in the early days of the Western frontier in the United States, there were something like 17 males for every female. But as a general rule, what tends to happen is there is more often a surplus of women in mating pools. One reason is the reason you alluded to, which is that men die off at a faster rate. Men die on average 7 years earlier than women. And so as you get older and older and more men die off, the sex ratio becomes imbalanced. And then there are other factors, things like wars, which tend to cause men to die more often than women. There are a variety of other things that can cause sex ratio imbalances.
What you're saying reminds me of an article that came out not too long ago, and what they were looking at was couples where the male is more attractive than the female. Most of the time, there's similarity. There's this, what did Darwin call, cross-character assortment, matching, anyway. So they did the study where they identified couples where the man was more attractive than the woman, and they had them interact and answer questions and talk to each other, and they had that same kind of back and forth with couples that were matched, but they found that the man was less supportive, seemed to be less committed to the relationship when his female partner was less attractive.
Yes.
That would be because he realizes that he actually could have, as they say, could have done better.
Precisely. And in couples where there is a mismatch in mate value, and I've done some studies of that, where you have the 8 who's mated to a 6, the person who's higher in mate value is more likely to cheat, more likely to be sexually unfaithful, and is more likely to break off the relationship. And if they stay, tends to be less committed to the relationship than the person who's lower in mate value.
So it kind of explains why when we have very attractive Hollywood couples, you know, their marriages don't last. Is that because they both, or is it because of the man? I mean, they realize that, or they get used to how attractive their partner is, but they have so many other opportunities?
That's part of it. In Hollywood, those who are high have tremendous opportunities for highly desired others, and so there are many, many more temptations to defect than most of us have.
I did an episode a while back on blaming the victim, and we talked about acquaintance or date rape. Someone made a good comment, which comes up when you talk about these kinds of things. And I think it was either in your article or your book, you mentioned that males have a tendency to interpret signals from females as implying potential sexual access. They do that faster than women might. So if you stare at her, if a girl looks at you, you're a guy, you might think she's interested. Is that right?
Yes.
You're pretty fast. First of all, why does that occur, you think?
Well, it is what I call the sexual overperception bias, and it occurs for a variety of cues. So, the typical one is smiling. When a woman smiles at a man, he's more likely to infer sexual interest, when in fact a woman might be simply being friendly or polite or even nervous. Men have this sexual overperception bias, I believe, because of the costs of failing to pick up on a potential mating opportunity. females, you can say, are the more valuable sex in many ways. They invest parentally this tremendous 9-month pregnancy, which is metabolically expensive. Men can reproduce by having one act of sex. Women have to undergo that 9-month heavy investment to reproduce. And so there's a great asymmetry in what's called obligatory parental investment. So what this means is that women are the more valuable reproductive sex in many ways. And so for males, a primary constraint on their reproductive success is going to be sexual access to women. For women, if they're reproductively valuable or fertile, gaining sexual access is generally not going to be a problem. Well, what their constraint is more obtaining high-quality men willing to invest in them and their children. So males have, I believe, as part of their short-term mating strategy, this sexual overperception bias, given that we live in an uncertain social world where we don't know exactly what someone's sexual interests are or might be. For males, it's better to err on the side of over-inferring sexual interest, even if you're going to be wrong sometime, than in under-inferring it and missing out on potential sexual opportunities. Now, of course, men aren't thinking about this consciously, but the way selection works is that over evolutionary time, these circumstances repeated again and again and again. Those males who missed out on sexual opportunities are not our ancestors, and that we are the descendants of those who were successful in picking up on whatever sexual opportunities happened to be there. It's analogous to a smoke alarm. You set it, your smoke alarm very sensitively because you don't want to miss out on any real fires that are there, but there are sometimes false alarms. And similarly, in the sexual overperception bias, there are false alarms, so to speak, you know, men make mistakes. They think the woman is sexually interested when, in fact, she's really not. But they also maximize successfully acting on those sexual opportunities that happen to be there.
Right. Okay, so if this is so, then I guess the point that she was making is, well, you mentioned this in one of your books, that if it's, well, if it's evolutionary, then it can't be changed. If let's say date rape occurs and he says, well, you know, she looked at me, she seemed interested, is it an excuse?
I think it's a fundamental misunderstanding that if something evolved, then you can't change it. You can change all these things. In the case of the sexual overperception bias, I think sometimes simply educating men and women about the nature of this sex difference, that men have this inferential bias that's like a psychological tick in their machinery, that can help men to understand that they're off sometimes and it might give them pause. It's clear that you can intervene successfully and change these things. So basically, raising the cost. You know, humans are cost-benefit calculators, and they're very sensitive to certain types of costs, such as social costs, reputational damage, etc. And so by raising the costs associated with certain abhorrent and criminal activities, such as rape, you can alter it. In fact, my lab is now exploring which intervention strategies are effective and ineffective in lowering sexual victimization rates.
So you're saying that while we have to acknowledge that males have that tendency to over-perceive interest, we can combat it with knowledge, and this is done every, you know, every fall. Every college has an orientation in which they talk about date rape. So educating men about this tendency and educating women about how men have that tendency and what to do is one way to combat it, and then having punishments in place.
Yes. The deeper understanding of our evolved mating psychology will give us more tools and lead to greater intervention efforts, you know, where intervention is required. So far from the error in thinking that if it's evolved, we can't change it, once we understand precisely what evolved, that is, what is our evolved sexual psychology, that will allow us greater opportunities for change where change is desired.
Okay, and then let me ask you this question related to this. Okay, so your explanation is evolutionary. Might someone say, well, you know, I guess it could be, I suppose, but couldn't it also be the way we bring up men and women? Maybe it has nothing to do with evolution. I mean, there's a lot of things you can see behavior in males and females that you would say, oh, well, it's evolutionary, and you could have quite an extensive explanation for it. But we don't take any explanation unless we can study it. And, you know, how do you go about demonstrating that the cause is evolutionary and not culture?
Well, I guess there are two levels at which that question can be answered, and perhaps maybe let me touch on each. The ground rules for operating in this arena are you generate a hypothesis about an evolved psychological mechanism, and the trick is to generate testable predictions, and then you do the empirical tests, either through experiments or other methods, observational methods, and see whether those predictions are verified. The more and more predictions you can generate about phenomena that have not yet been documented that follow logically from that hypothesis, the stronger your confidence that your original hypothesis is correct. That's basically the standard scientific procedure, you know, just like in all other branches of science. The problem with culture as an explanation is it tends to be invoked after the fact, and it tends not to lead to specific predictions. So in other words, coming along and saying, you say, okay, males have this sexual overperception bias, I think it's cultural. Well, what predictions does that stem from? What predictions follow from that? And there really aren't any, because culture is a vague hypothesis that typically invoked where people don't even identify who are the agents of cultural influence. Now, I'm not saying there aren't things that are cultural, because there are. But nonetheless, the whole game rests with generating testable predictions.
So let me throw this out at you. So I haven't done any research in this area, but let me just imagine a study along these lines. Suppose I had pictures of women smiling, and I'm going to, maybe 10 of them or something. I'm going to show those to a group of men, and I'm going to ask them, take a look at each picture and rate on a scale of 1 to 10 whether or not you think that woman is interested in you. At the end of all this, we get an average rating of like 8.5, which suggests that men think that women who are smiling at them might really have a sexual interest. Then you take pictures of men smiling and show those to women and ask them the same kind of question, and it comes out with a, you know, 4.5. If you had those kinds of results, would you interpret that as support for an evolutionary explanation?
Well, in that particular case, no, not by itself, because I think you'd want to design the experiment a little bit differently. You want to have, and this is what has been done, is basically you have videotapes of men and women interacting with each other for a few minutes, and then the woman smiles at the man, and then you stop the videotape, and then you ask male and female raters, what was the woman's intention behind the smile? What was she trying to do by smiling? And the results are that men are more likely to say, oh, she was sexually interested, and she was being seductive, she was being flirtatious, and women are more likely to say, no, she was just being friendly. By itself, I wouldn't make too much of that result. But here's an example of a prediction that you might generate.
Okay.
Is that this sexual overperception bias is a universal feature of male sexual psychology.
Yeah, you'd have to get it out of just our culture, right, in order to eliminate the culture as an explanation. Okay, so go ahead.
Right, exactly. So if you had an alternative explanation, such as, I think in America, through movies and other sorts of cultural products, men have learned this bias. So you go to different cultures that don't have the media exposure and do the tests as well. The cultural explanation would not predict universality of this sexual overperception bias. That would be one way to test it. Other examples of ways to test it, and that we are testing it, is that you would expect it to occur only in certain circumstances and with certain women. So, for example, we predicted that the sexual overperception bias would not occur in men with respect to their sisters. So if their sisters smile at them, men aren't going to infer sexual interest. So we predicted that in advance and documented it. Also predicted that the fertility or reproductive value of the woman would influence the magnitude of the sexual overperception bias. For example, we predicted that it will occur more for women who are in their early 20s, for example, highly fertile, than for postmenopausal women. And in fact, he even made a more precise prediction, and that is that the magnitude of the sexual overperception bias should follow the fertility curve or reproductive value curve. And so when you can generate precise predictions like that, then you're dealing with a fairly precise hypothesis, and if the results conform to that, then they support it. And I know of no other competing theory that generates those predictions. At least no competing theories have so far.
So like many other sciences, you gain confidence not in one or two studies, but in sort of coming at the problem from many different directions and finding supportive data from each one of those directions.
Yes, exactly. And another way to say that is that you evaluate these hypotheses by the cumulative weight of the evidence across studies. And it's extremely rare that any single study is definitive. One of the signs of advancement in the field is that we have had some evolutionary hypotheses that have been falsified. Some have been confirmed, some have been falsified, and that's a normal science.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you brought up the falsifiability piece of that. Well, you know, we've touched on a lot more than I thought we might in this period of time, because this is, would you say, one of the most exciting areas of research today in psychology?
It certainly is for me. Judging by students' reaction, I think it is for students as well. I mean, students absolutely love evolutionary psychology. My classes always have very, very long wait lists, and increasingly, classes are being offered throughout the country. I mean, it's actually one of the reasons that I wrote the textbook, Evolutionary Psychology, The New Science of the Mind, is because there was increasing interest in it, but until there's a textbook, you know, it wasn't getting on the books in curricula in psychology departments. So it is now both throughout the United States and throughout the world, and so it's really very gratifying to see evolutionary psychology mushrooming like it has been. Every year there's an increased treatment of evolutionary psychology in the intro textbooks as well.
Well, this has been a great interview. I appreciate it. I've got your textbook in front of me here, Evolutionary Psychology, but you also have a popular book, one that people could get, let's say, Amazon.
Yes. It's called The Evolution of Desire, Strategies of Human Mating. It's a book that is very accessible to everyone and captures all of what we know about human mating strategies, ranging from what characteristics people prefer in a mate, how we go about selecting a mate, how we go about attracting a mate, keeping a mate, poaching on others' mate, changes in mating over time, and it basically covers the conflict between the sexes. It covers the whole spectrum of our underlying psychology of human mating and what we know about strategies of human mating.
So it's called The Evolution of Desire.
Yes.
Very interesting. All right, well, I'm going to put links from my site to yours, and I've seen the pictures of you with your grad students there. They look like an energetic bunch.
Yes, they are. Very bright and energetic.
All right, well, Dr. Buss, thank you so much for taking this time with us. I really appreciate it. It's been very, very interesting.
Thank you for the interview. I mean, it's been most delightful chatting with you. Down the line, if you want to do one specially on mating strategies, I'd be happy to do that as well.
All right, take care.
Take care.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Buss. Very interesting interview. And if you have any questions, thoughts, or feedback, feel free to either leave them on the blog at www.thepsychfiles.com or email them to me, michael@thepsychfiles.com. I have a feeling I'll be talking to Dr. Buss again in the future, and if you would like him perhaps to respond to some questions you have about evolutionary psychology, I will pass them along and try to get some answers back to you. So finally, I just wanted to talk about episode 100. My thought on that episode is just to reflect back on the previous 99 episodes. I've had some thoughts about the process. It's been 2.5 years, and through that time, I've had some episodes which I really liked and really stuck with me, so I'd like to talk to you about those. I have learned a lot about psychology over the past 2.5 years. And I'd like to share some of key things, I think, that came out of the podcast. But I would be more than happy to hear from you. I am very indebted to the many people who are listeners to the Psych Files. So if you have some thoughts about the podcast, something you'd like to tell me about, and you know, if it's okay, I could certainly read some of them on the air on that episode. That's what I plan to do. So if you have any thoughts about the podcast you'd like to share, then I'd love to hear about them. That's coming up at episode 100. Hope you enjoyed episode 98, and I will see you again next time. Take care. Bye now.